This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Voice of San Diego podcasts are sponsored by the Bob Nelson Charitable Fund, honoring the San Diego Harbor Police Foundation.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. My name is Scott Lewis. I'm the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice San Diego, joined as always by assistant editor Andrew Keats. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Scott.
Managing editor Sarah Libby.
Hello.
Sarah. Coming up on the show today, the news is just not slowing down. We now have overlapping crises. We will talk about criminal justice injustices and the protests that have gripped San Diego and the nation. We've got a lot of news now on reforms that are suddenly moving forward for police oversight, and we'll break them down. And on the second half of the show, we're going to talk with Andrea St. Julian, who's behind a measure to increase police oversight in the city of San Diego. And I was finally able to fully report out my theories and worries about public schools. We'll talk about what could be on the horizon in coming months. But first, let's talk protests. It's quite surreal, obviously, to see this taking over the country. Last night, there was a big protest in Ocean Beach, and I took my cousin Lexi down to see it. So she's from Pierce, Colorado. There's not a lot of activity like that in 1,000-resident Pierce, Colorado. But it was quite a thing to see, and typical Ocean Beach, it ended in a weird drum circle where there was also chanting on top of it. But it made me reflect. I think there's obviously a lot of discussion about protests. You had the president even yesterday talking about how he called himself an ally of peaceful protesters. You had a U.S. senator say that peaceful protesting is fine, but we should send the troops in after the non-peaceful protests. But our Ashley McGlone this week explored how capriciously police can sometimes make that determination of when a peaceful assembly has flipped to an unlawful assembly. It's that moment that really makes the difference in these assemblies, these protests. That once you make that determination that an unlawful assembly has happened, it almost necessarily has to end in a type of violence, a clash. And, you know, some of those clashes are pretty much okay in a democracy. But what did she actually find? She found that over the last several days, there have been a lot of these declarations of unlawful assembly, but they aren't always clear why they made that determination.
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway from what she found is that it can just vary so wildly from department to department and even protest to protest and street to street. And so police have really broad authority to just make the determination on the fly. And it's usually always centered on some sort of outbreak of violence or the threat of violence coming out. But even then, police, you know, are obligated to make the call if they're able to sort of isolate bad actors. And SDPD, for its part, said that they don't necessarily have policies of what goes into making the call or who gets to make the call or how the, you know, instructions need to be communicated to a crowd before arrests and violence start taking place. So, you know, it can really be all over the place.
Yeah. So I think that's why it's so important, because once you decide, especially with this conversation about using the military or whatever, once you decide that a protest has gone violent and yet it's built on this capricious, you know, like definition of what might happen, or, you know, a bottle came flying through the air and thus this is now, you know, a problem. That's when we go from what might be just a healthy democratic clash, like just a, you know, protests are meant to provoke. You know, they're going to push boundaries. That's how it works. That's what you're feeling when you're inside one. And so to have that clash then turn into something that needs to be literally repressed, perhaps with the military, that's where I think we have flipped towards a big problem. And that's why it's so scary and so big of a deal to militarize the response. Like, that should be, as the defense secretary said yesterday before he changed his mind again, U.S. defense secretary I'm talking about, he said, you know, it should be the most dire situation where that's used. And if that messiness of when it's declared a violent protest exists and there's a militarized response, that's when you basically end the peaceful competition of ideas, in my opinion. That's where you end a republic.
Yeah, and this isn't the first time we've had to confront the arbitrary nature of this decision, which is a critical decision in terms of what plays out after it's made. In 2016, when now President Trump came to San Diego at the convention center, there were large protests. People marched from Barrio Logan down Harbor Drive. And eventually that was deemed an unlawful assembly, and it culminated with arrests, including the arrest of a then mayoral candidate, right?
City attorney. Yeah.
Candidate Brian Peace. We had a lengthy conversation then about just what it meant to determine that protest had crossed into an unlawful assembly. And say what you will about what has gone on with any protest in the country or in La Mesa this weekend, and when reasonable people may agree that some sort of line has been crossed. In 2016, I think if you were to look back at what specifically happened on the day of that protest, no one would make the case that it was the sort of destruction of property that might necessitate that sort of action. So it is. An arbitrary level of authority that they have to deem it, and they have wielded it arbitrarily in recent history as well.
Looting and arson are separate,
right,
criminal acts. And they, in my opinion, exist outside what we should be able to expect as a normal democratic clash. Even a tough, violent clash in the streets is different than looting and arson, which are expressly criminal acts. And the reason those are also distinguished, I think, from what's happening in the streets is that those have actual consequences to the victims of who are involved. The arson, you know, hurts the building, may even hurt people. The looting, obviously, of the private property of people who built up their lives. So I think, you know, we always have to work to, and unfortunately it's messy. It really is. But that's why, like, you can't militarize the response. You can't just blow off the militarization of the response because of how quickly it could be triggered in what is a normal and okay democratic experience. So right now we're having a lot of conversations in San Diego about the National Guard. They were called, the sheriff asked the National Guard to come here. There's going to be 100 of them in La Mesa. La Mesa is still tense because of another encounter between officers and a person of color in La Mesa who he was encountered. Why was that again?
He was allegedly smoking near a transit station.
Yeah. And so, you know, that got, you know, it was pretty clear he was manhandled by the police officer. And now the body cam footage and all that stuff's coming out, and they're worried that that's going to inflame, you know, more issues. So they've asked for National Guard to come down. Now, when I talked on Monday with Dr. Akilah Weber. She's a city councilwoman on La Mesa's city council. Gave me a riveting sort of play-by-play of how they made that decision late Saturday night, I guess early Sunday morning, about declaring a curfew, first curfew I have seen in San Diego since I've been here. And she described how they had asked for the National Guard to come and they couldn't get it. And that's what led to some further discussion.
Exactly. Once we got denied by the state for the National Guard, we said we have to do something. You know, and I spoke with the mayor and I said, we just need to meet. We need to get together and put our heads together and figure out what it is that we're going to do, because we can't not do anything. We don't want our entire city to be devastated and ravaged. So we got together, and that's when we, you know, we set the curfew, and the next morning we met, we declared an official state of emergency in La Mesa, declared an emergency in our city, and that gave us the ability to reach out and get more resources, officially put a city manager in charge of dealing with these things, and also implementing another curfew that went into effect last night, much earlier than it did the night before.
So still a tense feeling in San Diego, obviously a lot going on.
I'd say real quick that the reaction to the announcement that some National Guard would be coming to San Diego to some extent quickly became conflated with the national conversation around President Trump attempting to invoke an action that would allow military to be deployed into cities. And I think, as you can tell from listening to Dr. Weber speak there, this is a categorically different action than that. National Guard was, you know, even as late as last week, was requested. Their presence was requested by the La Mesa City Council, including Dr. Weber, and was rejected. And it'll be here now. But the National Guard is different than the military, and it would be inappropriate to conflate those two things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's commanded by the state, and you know there are residents. It's much different than the federal sort of authority being asserted, despite or in spite of maybe a governor's wishes. The discussion, though, obviously, everyone it seems was horrified by the image and the description of what happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis, and all of this discussion, along with the protests, has led to some rather rapid progress in criminal justice reform in San Diego. Andy, do you want to describe a couple of the things that have happened already and then a couple of things we're waiting for?
Yeah, so the first thing was an announcement. Well, there was a press conference on today is Thursday, that's correct. On Monday there was a press conference announced that there would be an announcement from the mayor. And he would be joined by the police chief, as well as Council President Georgette Gomez and Councilwoman Monica Montgomery. The presence of Gomez and Montgomery indicated, I think, that it was going to be a substantial announcement. We didn't know what it would be, but it indicated that it was not going to be some sort of anodyne call for peace and togetherness. What he had called the press conference to announce was that they were going to ban the use of the chokehold or the carotid restraint by SDPD. Now, this is an action that other departments in the country have already made, though not many of them. According to Campaign Zero, which is an activist group that includes D-Ray McKesson and others, about 28 of the top 100, the 100 largest police departments in the country had already banned that. So, you know, roughly 75% hadn't. SDPD joined those that has banned it now. And it's kind of been a watershed moment in the 2 days since then. Every department in San Diego County has now joined and banned it as well. Even
in spite of the sheriff right away jumped in and defended it when he was asked whether he would do something like that. And it couldn't have been 12 hours later that he changed, right?
That he changed. And then from there, the floodgates were open. Everyone announced it from then. There is now, at least according to these announcements, we will have to monitor implementation. That is important. And we'll have to see exactly what the language of the policy change says. But according to the announcement, there are now no law enforcement agencies in San Diego County that will permit use of chokeholds to restrain suspects.
And at that announcement, we asked what we thought might be just a quick question, sort of disregarded or parried, but it wasn't. This was Adriana Heldes was there. She asked the mayor if he would consider supporting a ballot measure that is working its way very slowly through City Hall that would create an oversight commission, including the right to investigate with subpoena power and to have an independent city attorney or an independent attorney work with this oversight commission to investigate police misconduct. She asked that question, would he in particular support the subpoena requirement? And this is what he had to say.
Yeah, that is moving forward. It will be on the ballot. We've been having a lot of very good, productive discussions with our Police Officers Association, and I look forward to giving it my full support.
So there's two news pieces in there. One is that it was going forward. It had been stalled in these labor negotiations with the police union before it could be placed on the ballot. And then ostensibly him saying there he supports it, but it's still not clear exactly what he supports.
Yeah, so this was another example of the sort of the dam breaking. In the day after Mayor Faulkner announced his support, District Attorney Summer Steffen did the same. And then eventually even the Police Officers Association itself announced that it would. So that has now forced people to start demanding to understand exactly what the measure is. The measure had a clear set of planks. You mentioned subpoena power. You mentioned independent attorneys. They would also have their own independent investigators that would be able to wield that subpoena power. So they would not rely on SDPD's internal affairs, and which is what the existing oversight body does. They can essentially just assess what the internal affairs overview determines. This would be a body that can conduct its own investigations. And so the question now becomes, how much, if at all, has that measure changed since it went into labor negotiations? And the group San Diegans for Justice that has proposed it and has pushed it as far as it has come held a press conference today to say, to essentially walk through the history of attempts to water down this measure in the past and sort of say that their guard is up for any sort of weakening of the measure that has led to this rush to join it. So I think I just want to say a couple things to watch on this measure. One thing that's gotten less attention but was spelled out here on this podcast when Eva Posner, who's a political consultant who's working on that measure, came on. This measure, something I think is really interesting about it, would have sort of an auditing power to see how much SDPD has implemented changes to state law that involve police officers. So any sort of change in police practices that is conducted at the state level, this agency would have the ability to look into SDPD's practices to make sure that they're abiding by that state law change. So I think that is something to look into. And then the other question that we'll have to ask mayoral candidates going forward and Mayor Faulkner as well is, if this body comes back and determines that they have found wrongdoing, that they believe that there is substantial evidence of misconduct, will they act on that? Will they press charges? What will be the recourse? So it's setting up this body is powerful and potentially a wide-reaching reform, but there are any number of ways that it could be implemented in practice. And so it is, to some extent, something that is very much a first step and that we need to continue to monitor going forward.
And I think both of those points that you just made are really important because SDPD has kind of a track record of not necessarily adhering both to its own reforms and to reforms imposed by the state. And we've done so much reporting over the last several years about both of these. Jesse Marks had a story this week about the ways in which the department complied with recommendations from an outside group commissioned by the Department of Justice. This was after a string of really gruesome officer misconduct cases involving sexual abuse, domestic violence, things like that. And, you know, the law sort of opening up a lot of police records only went into effect this year. So prior to that, the only peak we've really been able to get as far as whether these reforms have been working have come in the form of court cases. And the few times that we've seen those, the results have been really troubling. So Andy and I reported about the case of Neil Browder, who shot, an unarmed man in the Midway District in 2015, which was after these recommendations came out. And we found that you know, the department's internal affairs never interviewed him about the shooting. It didn't come up in his performance review. Literally no one ever talked to him about shooting an unarmed man, essentially on seconds upon arrival. It just wasn't discussed in any way. At no point did he have a conversation with somebody about, like, maybe that wasn't an ideal outcome. Here's how things could go better next time. He subsequently discharged his weapon into a baby's crib. And so, you know, it doesn't seem like these systems that they have in place always work or result in significant changes. And then the same goes for state reforms. You know, police unions fought tooth and nail to not have to adhere to this new public records law. We've seen that recent laws reforming the state gang database haven't necessarily worked out as planned. We saw SDPD found a loophole in the law that allowed them to collect DNA from juveniles without their parents' permission. That resulted in a subsequent law closing that loophole from Lorena Gonzalez after we reported on it. So I think, you know, we're talking so much about these new reforms to implement, which is great, but it's important to remember that they don't necessarily comply with existing reforms either.
Yeah, and connecting that to a point I made earlier on chokeholds, I mentioned DeRay McKesson and Campaign Zero. One of the things that they found, and I want to stress, you know, his group's movement they're pushing right now is called Eight Can't Wait. It's eight specific types of reforms that they say in their research have substantive data backing the fact that they would make a difference, that we could, if we enacted these eight reforms across the country, you could meaningfully change the number of people who die by police. And the chokehold, ending the chokehold, is one of those eight. So this is a substantial thing. But they've also found that New York City, for instance, announced that it was banning chokeholds, but in the policy banning chokeholds, it specified that on a case-by-case basis, chokeholds could still be used. On many of these things, it is very important to look past the initial statement and to check the implementation.
Well, our Jesse Marks also looked into this week a sort of review about what happened when the federal government sponsored an investigation into the San Diego Police Department because of such a rash of misconduct cases that we were dealing with way back in 2011 and 12, and what the follow-up or not follow-up was on some of their recommendations. It goes along with that theme of, yeah, it's one thing to implement reform. It's another thing to actually execute it over time. And, you know, you could tell there was a lot of people rattled by this. Jerry Sanders, his former police chief, was at that press conference. Former police chief, former mayor, was at that press conference with Mayor Faulkner. A lot of people trying to communicate that this time, this is the time that things have really changed. We will see. Well, as you all know, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is what is going to happen to schools? What is going to happen to schools? Are they going to open? Are they going to open in the fall? Are they going to do some sort of hybrid open where half go to school, half don't? Are they going to just do distance learning as they've threatened that they will? If budget cuts come as proposed by the governor, the state this week has been talking about not doing those cuts, but how secure is that? The County Office of Education provides guidance and sort of shared infrastructure, legal services, stuff like that for school districts. They also act as the kind of arm of the state overseeing their finances. So the County Office of Education is advising school districts to prepare for a lot of parents who aren't comfortable sending their kids back to school yet, or who have found themselves more comfortable with this homeschool platform and may switch to other platforms. And this sort of confirmed for me that there is a big problem coming. They're worried about the budget cuts coming from the state. That's one thing. But schools are funded right now by average daily attendance. You know, how many kids go to school every day? That's if your child goes to school, that school and that school district gets a certain number of dollars associated with that student per day. And so if they don't go to that school, that money will either go to the charter school home program they may choose, or if they just disappear or move away, as some have at Cajon Valley Elementary School District. David Miyashiro, the superintendent there, said that he has heard of hundreds of parents who have left the region because of the economic catastrophe. If even just 5 to 10% of parents do not send their kids back to traditional schools this fall, it could be itself a compounding financial problem on top of the state budget cuts that may come. And also, it's just that whole concept of, like, if you, you know, the whole argument that the San Diego Unified School District has been making for the last decade is you should not choose another school or a charter school or go to a different neighborhood. You should invest everything you have into your neighborhood school. You should be and build a good community around that school that will hold standards high and will make a better environment for learning and for teachers to stay. And if you literally can't participate in that community, you wonder how many of the most motivated parents will stick with it. And I gathered some anecdotes about that and finally put it together in a piece. An enrollment crisis is coming for school districts. I appreciate it if you'd read it on the site. I think there's a lot going on there. But then there was this last point that even if they do open up schools, Bob Mueller from the County Office of Education told me, think about the logistic challenge they may have with just even minor sort of requirements. If they say, for example, that you have to have temperature checks just to get into the school, imagine 400, 500, 600 kids getting temperature checks every morning. And then he said this, he said, we have to buy thermometers, masks, and hand sanitizer in a volume I cannot even estimate. It's like, ooh, that's a lot. And it makes me wonder, like, can't they use the construction bonds for hand sanitizer? Can they use some of the money they have raised for something like that?
Yeah.
They've gotten creative before.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, creative interpretations are what these bond measures are made for, right?
Yeah.
It dawned on me when I was listening to a conversation about college football coming back, and somebody made the point that for many of these schools, the amount of testing required is cost prohibitive. And I was thinking, like, man, if the complex logistical realities of getting college football back are, like, too costly to make feasible, then what chance do public schools, your neighborhood elementary school have? If the SEC can't figure it out, how can OB Elementary figure it out?
No, it's true. It's like, and I asked, you know, UC San Diego is embarking on a vast testing tracing plan so that they can get educators and students and researchers back to campus. But I asked this Bob Mueller from the county if that was something he could foresee for schools. And it was like, it wasn't even a thing. It wasn't even a possibility to imagine that amount of testing and that sort of facilitating that. He said he hadn't heard of anything like that. And yet, to me, that seems like the only possible route. Like, it seems like it's either distance learning or you test and test and test and somehow try to give as many people as much confidence as possible that they can go and they can contain it if something happens.
No, the few sort of California universities, to Andy's point, that have said they're going to come back in some form, USC said that this week, and UC San Diego, I think, has already made a similar call, are completely reliant on, you know, really aggressive testing and all these extra measures, putting those into place. And so how that works across every single school is really hard to imagine.
Yeah, the only thing I could see coming to the aid of the districts is that we do have a few months ahead of us, and as long as it feels like we've been dealing with this, it actually is only 3 months, which is about the amount of time when, you know, school would be ramping up again. Nah, not quite. I mean, school comes back earlier than the September timeframe that it sort of comes back in my brain, but. My point is, this is an evolving situation, and it is maybe a bit fatalistic to presume that in 2 to 3 months we'll be where we are now, but
That said, yeah. I mean, that said, like, they're going to have to tell people at some point what's going to happen
right.
before the actual start of fall. And they haven't done any of the normal sort of orientations and preparatory, like enrollment estimating and stuff like that. And as Bob Mueller from the county said, look, it is literally still prohibited for them to have classes. Right now, we just checked the updated public health order. It says all public, private schools, colleges, universities shall not hold classes or other school activities. That has to change, obviously, for any of that to go forward. So obviously, I'm really worried and interested in that story, and we'll continue to follow it. We're going to take a quick break. On the other side, Sarah Libby is going to talk with Andrea St. Julian about the proposed measures that we've been talking about to overhaul oversight of the San Diego Police Department. Stay with us.
All right, I am talking with Andrea St. Julian, who's an attorney and co-chair of San Diegans for Justice and president of the Earl B. Gilliam Bar Association. Hello, Andrea.
Hello, Sarah.
All right, so there's been a lot of action and attention on this ballot measure being pushed forward by San Diegans for Justice this week. Kevin Faulkner, Summer Steffen have signed on, but this is actually something that's been sought after for years. Can you give us a little history about how this has evolved?
Yeah, and it's great that you mentioned all of the elected officials who have kind of signed on now, because it's been a really long history with this charter amendment, and unfortunately, it has been a history that has been filled with really betrayal and sabotage. In 2016, Women Occupy San Diego presented a similar charter amendment to the city council. It was met with professed support and smiles. The city council then took the charter amendment and totally gutted it. What they then did was put Measure G on the ballot, which in the end did little more than change the name of the Citizens Review Board to Community Review Board. So then it came to 2018, and at the beginning of that year, we submitted another charter amendment proposal. Again, we were met with smiles, you know. People were saying, the city council members were saying they supported it. But for some reason, the hearing to place the charter amendment on the ballot kept getting postponed. Month after month, it kept getting postponed. So then when it was finally time to vote on it, the city council said, oh, it's too late. We can't vote on it now. There's not enough time to send it to what they call a meet and confer process with the Police Officers Association. So that was, again, clearly sabotage. And so when I look at what's happening today, it's feeling very familiar, actually. We submitted the current charter amendment for placement on the 2020 ballot at the beginning of 2019. In November of 2019, it was finally sent to what they call the meet and confer, which is a meeting with the Police Officers Association. That charter amendment has been in meet and confer for 6 months.
Yeah.
Meet and confer is a secret process, so we're not allowed to know what goes on. We have no idea what is happening with the charter amendment. We have no idea whether it's been chopped up, whether it's been gutted. We have no idea. And so this time is feeling very familiar because we've seen this happen before. So when Mayor Faulkner says he supports the charter amendment or that he supports it, I don't know what he's talking about. I don't know if he's talking about the proposal that we submitted or if he's talking about some chopped up version that was created during the meet and confer process. Same thing with the statements of the DA and president of the Police Officers Association. So when the elected officials come on and say they have support, you know, it really doesn't mean anything because they're not really being specific enough. What exactly do they support? You know, so.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think probably somebody who's following it at a surface level would see everything that's happened this week and say, you know, what a big victory for your effort. And you're saying you're still very wary and you're waiting to see how it plays out. So what's on your radar between now and the city council discussion, which I think has been docketed at this point?
Yeah, it was docketed actually, I believe, today for June 23rd. Right. Again, the problem is we haven't seen the language. We have never seen the language, you know? And for example, in a related matter, when Mayor Faulkner announced his support, I was surprised. For years, we've asked for Mayor Faulkner to sit down and talk with us about the charter amendment. He never accepted any of our invitations. When he made this announcement, he had, you know, never spoken to me or the or our organization. I'm the principal writer of the charter amendment. I am the co-chair of the organization that is supporting the charter amendment. Yet, I get no calls. So when they say their support, I don't know what that means.
So what do you see as being the most meaningful pieces in this measure that you're going to, you know, hope and insist make it through the process?
The first thing is independence. Right now, we have a community review board that is merely a board. It's an advisory board to the mayor. So it's completely dependent on the mayor and the mayor's office. The problem with that is when there's something that needs to be reviewed and looked at, people don't trust the current community review board because it's not independent. Another example of its lack of independence is that the city attorney is required to be the attorney for the community review board. This is the same city attorney who is the attorney for the police department. All right? So when people look at that, they think, wait a second, how can the attorney whose duty it is to protect the police department properly advise the review board, who supposedly has a duty to make recommendations regarding police conduct? So that independence is really key just in terms of how the new commission is formed. And that was one of the things we made sure. Independence is something that's key. And then there are more specific features of what is in the charter amendment. The first one, of course, is that the new commission is going to have the power to actually investigate complaints against the police department and or police. People are really shocked when I tell them that the community review board, the current board, has absolutely no power to independently investigate any complaints against police officers. None. And people are stunned. But that is the case. That is absolutely the case.
Yeah. Earlier in the podcast, I was discussing a specific officer-involved shooting that we've covered really aggressively that happened in 2015, and it was a shooting of an unarmed, mentally ill man by an officer, and we were pretty shocked to learn in that officer's depositions, because the family sued over it, that Internal Affairs never interviewed him. He's the officer involved. It never came up in his performance review or anything like that. And so I think the ability to sort of seek out answers on its own is something that, you know, you would think would happen with some of these investigations. But that sort of gets to what my next question is. And this is a point that Kelly Davis made, who's a great criminal justice reporter in town, which is that, you know, the separate review board that deals with the sheriff's department does have some of these powers and distinctions that make it more independent. It has a subpoena power. It has its own legal counsel, as you were discussing. And yet it rarely uses those powers, and it continues on a lot of cases to really defer to the county. So I guess I'm just interested in your thoughts on that and how, even if you put some of these structures in place, how do you ensure that aggressive oversight really takes place?
Yeah. I think when I first sat down to write the charter amendment, the first thing I did was call boards and commissions across the country to find out what worked and what didn't. We also talked to community members, because this is really the community's charter amendment. And one of the things that we found is you cannot require a body to investigate every single complaint. Because what happens then is the resources that you need to put into investigating the really bad, tough complaints gets sucked up by the little complaints that really don't need investigating. And that was one of the problems with the county CLRB. There were cases that were not investigated. They ran out of time in terms of investigating them because right. They have the duty to investigate every complaint.
Right. And so there were some really serious, you know, death in custody cases that just got tossed out entirely and were never investigated.
Yeah, because they were too busy investigating every single complaint, including ones that didn't need investigation. So that is a mistake that we avoided with the current commission. So, in fact, we only have a handful of cases that the commission is required to investigate, and that's in custody deaths, shootings, those kind of things. And those only total about, you know, anywhere between 6 to 12 cases a year. The rest of the complaints, the commission has the discretion to investigate. So that is really helpful in making sure that the commission can do an effective job. And in terms of subpoena power, giving the commission subpoena power is important. For the commission to actually use it is a little less important. Because what happens is, as long as the commission has the power to do it, the Police Officers Association and the police department will enter into an agreement where the commission will say, okay, we agree not to subpoena your officers if you agree to require them to talk to us. So that's really how that works. You don't want to have to use subpoena power. But the thing is, if you don't have subpoena power, no one is going to feel compelled to come and talk to you voluntarily. So it's important to give them the power. It's less important for them to use it. Because people knowing that they have the power, they'll avoid it and they'll just come and talk to the commission anyway.
Interesting. Are there any safeguards in the measure to assure that there's adequate staffing and adequate funding so that it can't just be sort of, you know, underfunded into irrelevance?
That's a really important question. That is, as always, a huge concern. It is a problem that other commissions and boards across the country have faced, that there are times when, yeah, you'll have this really robust set of powers, but they can't really use them because they don't have the money or funds to do so. In one of our earlier versions, in fact, the version that we actually submitted to the City Council, we did have in there a requirement for funding. Unfortunately, at some point that came out because the City Council didn't believe that it gave them the appropriate room to, you know, make an appropriate budget. So that did come out. The safeguards will have to be the safeguards that we always use, and that's vigilance. You know, there is no set of laws or rules that are going to work unless people require them to be implemented, unless we're vigilant. And so that's just one of the things that we're just going to have to be vigilant about.
So we've been talking a lot about, you know, allowing the commission to have all these planks in place so that they can conduct really aggressive investigations. How do we put those investigations, turn them into action? Say they did make significant findings. Is that entirely dependent on the council and the mayor, or does the commission itself have any say over what happens?
The commission does have the ability and actually is required to make recommendations based on what they find. So they do make recommendations to the mayor and to the police department on what the appropriate actions should be. So that's important. Also, the new commission is going to have the duty to publish its results to the extent that it's allowed to. So again, this is one where the public is going to have to be vigilant. It's going to have to look and see what the findings were, you know, because it's all going to be out there and all available. And the public will just have to demand implementation of the recommendations.
So we've seen really swiftly this week, law enforcement agencies across the county decide to ban the use of chokeholds. And we've seen, you know, elected leaders embracing this measure, whatever form it ultimately takes. Are there any other changes that you'd like to see local law enforcement embrace that you're thinking about?
There are, yes, a number of changes. A number of changes. And in fact, many organizations that are concerned with criminal justice reform here in San Diego have gotten together and put out a list of the top 5 or 6 reforms that will be made. I don't want to say have to be made because it's just more important than that. They will be made. And they include things like a robust de-escalation policy. And it has to be an official policy. And that's really important in terms of the charter amendment, because when the commission gets a complaint, in order to really evaluate that complaint, it's got to evaluate it against set policies. If we've got a really good policy on de-escalation, the new commission is going to say, okay, we can substantiate that this policy was not followed. So that's really important. Another one is, you know, stopping low-level arrest for low-level crimes like, you know, encroachment and loitering and, you know, all of those really very small misdemeanors that are little more than just harassment. And so that's something that's really important.
And so many of these incidents that have, you know, sparked such outcry began with enforcement of really minor infractions, whether it was using a counterfeit $20 bill or selling loose cigarettes or walking in the middle of the street.
Yeah. Yeah. The list of reforms that we'll be putting out actually today really go to reducing contact, that initial contact between officers and the public when that's not necessary. Because it's those small contacts that most of which weren't even necessary that all of a sudden escalate into horrible things. So if we can cut that down, we can reduce the amount of trauma that happens as a result of that contact.
I wanted to ask you, have you had any interactions with the police in San Diego or elsewhere that have troubled you? I've just heard so many personal stories from Shirley Weber and Genevieve Jones Wright and, you know, very public people in San Diego who all seem to have a story.
Yeah, I can say that, and I think that this is really important to say, I have not had any personally bad interactions with the police. And in fact, I've had some positive interactions with the police. And that's really important for people to know. My Uncle John was a police officer. When I started writing this charter amendment, the first thing that I did was I called a family friend in the town I grew up in, who was chief of police for our city. And, you know, When I wrote this charter amendment, it was about protecting and keeping everybody safe, including police officers. I deeply care about life and lives, and I want to protect lives of everyone, whether or not they are police officers. Because sometimes there are people who want to paint those of us who are interested in criminal justice reform as police haters. And nothing could be further from the truth. You know, I want to protect the life of that police officer just as much as I want to protect the life of just a regular person walking down the street.
All right. Is there anything else you want to add about the measure or any of the reform efforts you're working on?
With respect to the charter amendment, I would say that contrary to the impression that officials are trying to portray, this is not over. We're not even close. There has not even been a vote to get it on the ballot, and let alone a decision on what the it is, what exactly the charter amendment is. So I really hope that people understand that this is an ongoing struggle, that we need everyone's support. I would ask everyone to go to SanDiegansForJustice.com and read the charter amendment. Sign up to get emails. We also have an ability for you to write your city council member and tell that person, don't mess up this charter amendment. Don't change it. Don't gut it. We need a robust, independent, citizen-led oversight commission, and this is the one.
All right, Andrea St. Julian, thanks so much for talking with us today.
You're very welcome.
Great, that was great.
Thank you. Sarah, you're so well informed.
Oh, I've been covering these issues for years, and I mean, it's sad to see them come to light in this way, but, you know, gratifying in a way too, which I'm sure you understand.
That was local attorney and co-chair of the group San Diegans for Justice, Andrea St. Julian, and Voice of San Diego editor, Sarah Libby. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego, period. Keep up with all of our coverage with the Morning Report newsletter. Get that at vosd.org/morning. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief. Andrew Keats is Assistant Editor. Sarah Libby's Managing Editor. And this show was expertly produced by Nate John. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week.